boy.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Thank you, Maurice. I've known Maurice a long time, and we have a lot of fun together. So many of you came up to remind me of the Saturday Morning Fever group. Saturday Morning Live group that I tried to send out for some potted mums to raffle off, but we couldn't find any of them. I love coming to sessions, and I think I've spoken here a couple times before, and it's always an honor, the work that goes into this, and it's such a celebration. So many from nearby come down here for the whole week and just relax and visit with each other and go to some of the local meetings, and it's just great. My sobriety date is December 7th, 1964. And I had the same sponsor for 42 years, 2 months, and 2 weeks. And he passed away this year. His name was Bill Terwilliger. And I decided to just mention his name for the rest of the year because he meant so much to me. And that's a wonderful privilege to have the guy that comes to your house. Back then, that's how you got a sponsor. He came to your front door in response to a phone call to Intergroup. And from the day he knocked on the door until now, I never have had a drink. So it was just a miracle that that happened. And I'm 76 years old. I have 6 children and 15 grandchildren. My sister has 30 years in AA in Connecticut. I have 2 daughters in AA. One of them's here today, Conway, and I have a grandson in AA. So you can see that the Beach family is doing their share to ensure that the membership of AA continues to grow. So I hope all of you will try and do the same thing. I like to talk about AA itself and our program, and so I'm going to limit my story to maybe 15 or 20 minutes and get the condensed version. I'm so sick of hearing it. It's just, I'm tempted to tell Clancy's story just to see how much trouble I can get in with him. But anyway, I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut in the 30s. It was a different world back then. Just came out of the Depression. Went into World War II. The country was really united. And it was basically a very happy home environment, even though we were all sacrificing and everybody was pulling together. We were all on the same team. It was really an amazing situation. My parents were very nice. My sister was very nice. We were taken care of. We were taken to church. And so the facts of my life are quite nice. My editorializing on the facts of my life made me miserable because I decided that growing up in this very nice house was awful and that I didn't belong there. Nobody liked me. I didn't understand why I didn't belong anywhere. And I made myself quite uncomfortable with all of this. For years, I thought the Catholic Church was totally responsible for my alcoholism. My sister sat next to me and thought it was the greatest place in the world, and she still goes there. She thought the nuns were cute. She thought the Latin was great. The incense was wonderful. And confession was just the most wonderful relief, and isn't it fun? And I, on the other hand, felt like it was in Auschwitz and was terrified by everything. I just felt like, my God, I hope I never die because I know what happens then. And just the fear of dying ruined my life for years. And I was probably 9 or 10, and the crucifix spoke to me. I was staring at it, and it said, "Little boy, do you see this?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I can't miss this, right in front of me every week." Well, this is what God did to his only son that he loved. Guess what he's going to do to you? And I went, "Oh." So, no one said that. No one taught me that. I thought it up and scared myself to death. And as life goes along, I continue to editorialize on my own life in such a way that I made myself miserable. And this, my friends, is what we call our story. So my story is that I had a very rough childhood, was persecuted by the Catholic Church, and was driven to drink by the way you all treated me. And so I was very uncomfortable, but I was a good student, good athlete. I went to a little prep school in New Haven that went right into Yale. I went down there. I had worked on their buildings. I was a townie, you know, but when I got there and all these smart guys came from all around the country, I felt like I didn't belong. I thought the dean of freshmen was going to call us all out on the old campus and go, "Gentlemen, we have an imposter in our midst. He's right there." And they were going to get me out of there because I was not in their league. I didn't belong. I could tell that. I could feel it. And I was at an event one night where we were supposed to meet each other. I went in. That was very hard for me to do, to walk up to groups of people that I don't know and get to know them. And I would walk up to the groups and they would turn and look at me and all of their eyes said, "Go away, we don't want to know you." And it's hard to approach people who hate you ahead of time. And I went to each group and they all gave me the same message. It was clear as a bell, so I met no one. And there was a bar there, so I said, my roommates are going, "You're in college, you're not drinking." "No, I don't want to drink. But I decided to have one and see what they were talking about. And so I sat there talking to the bartender. I had about 2.5 drinks. I concluded that it really didn't work that well. Turned around to leave, and you've all heard this, many of you. I looked back, and there were 30 guys in that room that were dying to know me. Everywhere I looked, they were all going, "Hey, God, I'd give anything to be your best friend. Please come over here." So alcohol didn't change me. It changed the world that I lived in into a very friendly place. Everyone was wonderful. And I'm sure you've all experienced that. I've been in, many years later, in advanced alcoholism, I've been in some dumpy little bar somewhere. Around my 11th drink, I start sobbing, and the bartender says, "What's the matter?" And I said, "I'm overcome by the beauty of your customers." They're the most wonderful people on the face of the earth, and they're all here in this bar. So I guess you know what I'm talking about. It was almost a spiritual experience. Something happened on the inside of me that made the world wonderful and made it look wonderful. And that's what our program does. And if you're new, that's what this, all the steps are for, is to transform the world by changing you so that it's a great place to live in and there's nothing for alcohol to fix. And when there's nothing for alcohol to fix, it's pretty easy to not drink. And we just have to maintain that through our spiritual program. And sobriety is just as simple as can be. Anyway, once I started drinking, everything went, the grades, the athletics, I'm getting in fights, I'm going to jail, barely graduated, the Korean War was going on, the draft, everybody had to join the military, a bunch of guys were drinking beer, and one of them said, let's join the Marine Corps. I said, yeah, that sounds like great, great, you know, I think I even brought my golf clubs. And of course, it was a rude awakening to get there. I still can remember saying to myself, man, these guys ought to loosen up. This is, they're too intense here. Well, you know what happened. They get you and, boy, they do a job. And I got through with that boot camp stuff, and then we went for 6 months to become an infantry platoon leader. And I started to love it. I just loved the camaraderie, I loved the focus, and it just was amazing. It's the only organization that I loved besides AA. I just felt a part of something for the first time in my life. I saw a training movie about pilots, it looked very exciting. I'd never been in a plane, but it looked exciting to me, so I signed up to become a pilot. And I had met a lovely woman from Connecticut, and we got married and went off to the great Pensacola, Florida, home of naval aviation. I got airsick flying down there, and got airsick in the first 5 or 6 flights in the old SNJ. But it went away, and I turned out I was very good at it. So I'd be number 2 or number 3 in my class all the way through. It takes 18 months, and you do all the formation and bombing and gunnery and the carrier and all that stuff. And lo and behold, I end up with my wings, and I'm in a squadron at El Toro, California, a jet fighter training squadron, on my way to Japan to fly some of the fastest planes we had then. And the war was over. So when we got to Japan, the only thing we could do was fly high-performance planes and drink. That was my job for 14 months, was to fly wonderful planes with a bunch of wonderful guys and drink. And it was just amazing. Back then, they don't drink so much anymore, but boy, we drank with the colonel, and the colonel ordered the drinks, and And everyone drank as fast as I did, so I didn't have to sneak drinks. You know how you'd have to get up and go, I'll be back, I got to go to the bathroom. Then you'd drink one at the bar and come back. And this whole crowd was drinking fast enough so that I enjoyed the pace. And I felt part of that. I loved it. It was just wonderful. Now, I was getting a little trouble here and there, but I was still flying all the missions and staying with them. But 9 months into that tour, we were practicing to go aboard the carrier, and we were out at the end of the runway watching some of our buddies screw up practicing. That's what you do. You comment on each other's performance. And this major was talking with me about how he's going to get promoted, get his own squadron. And he wants nothing but the best pilots. And he looked at me, a young lieutenant, and he said, and I want you. And that felt like $1 million. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. And I had no idea. Why would he say that? I get drunk with this guy all the time. I have no idea what he meant. It wasn't until I got to AA that I realized that my drinking scared heavy drinkers. Alcoholics drink much differently than heavy drinkers if you watch them for a whole year. We drink when we have the flu. They don't. You know what I mean? We never stop, and we drink with an intensity that is, there's a look about us. And they go, I don't know what it is with that guy, but it makes me nervous. And, of course, when they came back to the States, they cut back and drank as the people were back here, and I drank alcoholically. So we ended up having 6 children. I got transferred all around was a forward air controller, and then I was a flight instructor, and then I got into photo planes during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we were flying a very high-performance plane, and I was at the end of my rope. The disease of alcoholism was now taking over. And I found it almost impossible to stay in the airplane for the full hour and a half. I needed to get out of there. You know how when you're having withdrawal symptoms, you've got to get out of the car. You can't even stay on the chair that you're in. I got to get out of here. Well, it's hard to get out of there. And I just, everything was happening. I was sweating. I couldn't see. My vision would start to go, and then my heart would race. And I thought I was going to pass out, and I would fly with my hand on the ejection seat, and I'd fly the mission with one hand up here. Some theory that if I passed out, I'd fire the seat, and I'd go out, and the chute would open automatically at 10,000 feet. I would land safely. The plane would crash. Problem solved. You know what I mean? It's pretty bad to think that up, but to accept it is wild, isn't it? And there came a time we had two types of airplanes. One was this high-performance photo plane. The other was an easy-to-fly electronics countermeasure plane with two seats. It had the radar guy, and we had two types of missions that we did. And I remember flying back from across country, and some very unusual things happened. And they weren't too clear in my mind. And about 3 months ago, I was out in California, and I was asked to lead the Brentwood group, which is about 500 people, after going to Clancy's group with 950 people. God, it's amazing. And a woman was coming there to celebrate 30 years, and her husband drove her there. He wasn't in AA. And she mentioned my name as they were driving up, and he said, "Geez, I want to talk to that guy." And she said, "My husband's outside. He wants to talk to you." So I went outside, and there's this man standing there, a nice man. I never saw him before. And he said, "In 1962, you were flying an F-3D-2Q radar plane. You were coming back from across country, and you declared an emergency. There was a flight of four. You said that the oxygen was bad in your plane, and we had to land immediately. So all four planes diverted to a nearby Air Force base, and we went in, and there was nothing wrong with the oxygen. And you never flew again." And I said, "Well, how do you know that?" He said, "I was in the plane with you." And I don't remember him at all. And it turned out there was a hurricane coming up to Cherry Point, and whenever hurricanes come, you fly all the planes somewhere else. That's how you protect them. And then you just drink till the hurricane goes. So those planes that were going, they didn't have any radar observers in. They had another pilot because he was going to drink. And so I had a pilot flying with me, and he flew it back. Now, that cleared up, you know, how foggy our minds are. But it did something else that's absolutely important. And if you're new, I want you to learn this lesson. When I came back from that, I announced that I couldn't fly anymore. And I was in a very exclusive squadron that's all senior people, only 15 pilots. And I felt like the biggest failure in the world, because this was my whole life. I've been doing it for 13 and a half years. And I knew that they were looking at me like, "What a wimp." And it took about 3 months before I got orders to become an air traffic controller, which is another story. And during that 3 months, I would come into that squadron, and they were all flying, and I'm hanging around. I did the legal work and some of the special court-martials, but I was basically the has-been. And I could tell the way they were looking that they were could hardly wait till I got out of there. And then they had nothing but really solid guy pilots. And this guy said to me, "Did you know how popular you were in that squadron? They were doing everything they could to keep you flying. They just loved you. So what was I to do with that new information? I had to go back and change my past. My story about that particular episode was wrong, and I had to put in the current information. And I call that process erase. And the reason I bring it up, I'm going to talk about it later on in my talk, is that's what all of spirituality is. It's erasing all the wrong information that we assembled about ourselves, the people on this planet, and the world. All of it. Until the only thing that remains is God's world filled with God's children, which is how we started out. So God created me, and then I recreated me with my story. And it was very lonely in that story because there's no God in there. There's just me. I'm the center of my story, just like we're the center of our dreams. Did you ever have a dream you weren't in? Probably not. So when you're the center of this whole thing, and it's you, and then all of them, and everything else, that's a very frightening place to live. But that's where I was, and I didn't know any different. Anyway, I did go on. I became an air traffic controller, which is absolutely ridiculous. Here's the pilot and drunk and can't walk and fly or anything, and now he's going to bring planes in bad weather. But anyway, I passed the school. I went overseas, and that's my last year drinking. And the senior enlisted men saw me when I checked into the unit, and they knew. And they just went, "Captain, good to have you here. Here's your tent. Oh, here's your little chair, the little captain's chair." And they said, "Look, sir, you just come to work every day. You just show up, and we'll take care of everything. But we don't want you to go near the radar and talk to any airplane. Because we really value the lives of the pilots in this air group." And so by that time, I was drinking round the clock, had no problem. I understand. It was a master gunnery sergeant, and I said, "I understand. You got it." And I was just surviving. So now I drank around the clock. I stopped eating. I lost 50 pounds. I had malnutrition. I didn't go to happy hour. I didn't talk to anybody. I was just trying to survive on alcohol and soup and juice, because solid food just wasn't going down. And that was a very difficult 14 months. I came back to the States, and that's how I ended up in Washington, D.C., to Quantico Marine Base in Virginia, to attend a career school. And somebody asked me to tell this story. While I was in, it was called junior school. And it was what you took about 4 months of school, and then you were eligible to get promoted to the next rank. And I was in such bad shape that I would go to the school and I couldn't remember what classroom I was in. So somebody would get me and go, "You're in our class." Okay. And I had no idea what the assignments were or anything. I was starting to get ready for a seizure. And then it would be physical education, and I'd go to my locker, which had a combination lock. And I can remember sitting there for the entire physical education break trying to unlock the combination lock, you know what I mean? It was beyond my skills. Because the combination was right there. I couldn't remember if I had just turned to the right or the left. And so I'd start all over again. No, I already did that. No, I didn't. And so I lived off the base, and I came into class one morning. I went by the front gate, saluted, drove up to junior school. It was just three or four large brick buildings. And the buildings were gone. And I remember looking around. I said, man, how the hell did that happen? I said, I better report this to the front gate. So I went back out the gate. I had just come in, made a U-turn, pulled up, and the corporal said, yes, sir? I said, Corporal, junior school is gone. And he said, what? I said, I just drove up there. It's gone. And so he said, whoa, we better get it. And he got the red light, and we drove back up. Much to my surprise, it was back. So I said to him, it's back. So I guess we'd all like to hear his version of that morning. Anyway, while I was at that school, I had a grand mal seizure, and I just about bit my tongue in half, and they rushed me off to Bethesda Naval Hospital. They had no alcohol program then, so you couldn't be an alcoholic. You had to have something else. And so I was there after having this seizure, and they're studying what it could have been. And it took about 5 days without alcohol for me to go into the delirium tremens, which are very scary. And I was being haunted by the CIA. They're trying to break me with mental tests. And it was just freaking me out because they were going to lock me up forever if I kept flunking these tests. And I think it all came from anybody went to a nut ward. The first question they ask you is count backward from 100 by 7. They do it everywhere. And you go, hey, 93? And you can't go any further. So then they go, uh-huh. And I think that started it. And I'm going, I know how to do it. Give me more time. I can figure it out. And I think that led to these things. Anyway, I was running around the hall, and they got me, put me in a straitjacket, and locked me up for 6 months in the mental ward. And in there, eventually, an AA meeting talked their way in. And three of us went down, and we listened to these guys. And I really thought that it was wonderful. I didn't think I had a problem. But I thought AA was wonderful, and eventually, in the last month or so, I was an outpatient coming back home, driving back up during the weekdays, and during that time, I decided to have a beer to watch a Redskin game, and didn't have anything go wrong, drank a beer, nothing happened, I must be a former alcoholic, and so then I got a bottle of vodka, and now I got the vodka in the nut ward with me, and they told me if I ever drank again, my career was over. So you can see I'm in a bad spot. So I called AA, Pearl Harbor Day, 1964. My sponsor was the only member of the Marine in the AA group at Quantico, outside of Quantico, Dumfries Triangle. He came to my house, took me to Manassas Group, and that was it. And that was in 1964. Since then, it has been the most amazing journey. It makes being in a fighter squadron seem like peanuts compared to what AA has to offer. Our program is just amazing. And I really want to talk about that. I want to share some of my thoughts about what it really does for us. But I want to interrupt and give a public service announcement. I was, and I've debated, I asked a lot of people about this, and it's mixed, so bear with me. But I was doing the steps down in Tampa, like I did at Saturday morning live, and I was really putting more effort into it. I did the history life for the 40s and then the 50s and the 60s, and I just was trying to cover every single thing I could, including the traditions. And I said, you know, you've never covered the service structure in a talk, because I do a lot of service work, but I've never been part of the service structure. So I went and got all of it down so that I knew we had 94 areas in Canada and the United States and the delegates and their term and how many trustees and how Bill changed it from having more non-alcoholics than alcoholics over to more alcoholics than 14 and 7. And the staff up at the World Services rotates every 2 years, and they do this and that. So I had it all down. And a friend of mine said, you know, if you really want to get a lot of information, there's a wonderful website named after Dr. Silkworth. So I went in there, and it's silkworth.net. And man, they had AA timelines. It was just the most wonderful thing. One item caught my attention, and it was AA's legal actions. And I said, what is that? Well, it listed all the lawsuits that World Services has done against AA members. And I had never heard of any of them. And so I read about it, and it's mostly copyright problems and suing people that printed up a lot of free books and distributed them in Germany and so on down. I'm only mentioning it because everybody I talked to had never heard of it. Never. I mean, I've talked to a whole bunch of old-timers. Now, how could I not know about that? And so I'm just throwing it out there. It seemed like I should have heard about that. Probably my fault that I wasn't involved more, but the thrust of it was that, sure, we don't get enough income in off of the donations, so they have to rely more on the literature income. But there was a few people who wrote in there, and I thought it was fascinating. And it basically was, we are a spiritual fellowship, and we will be taken care of by a loving God, not loving lawyers. And that was the thrust of this. So that's the end of the public service announcement. And be my guest and take a look at all that. Now back to having fun. If you're new, let me just now talk about what I think happened to me as a result of AA. Clearly, I indicated before that it allowed me through these steps to see everything differently. My great hero, Chuck Chamberlain, who was an AA member out in the West Coast, he's passed away a number of years ago, and he did a men's retreat, and they taped it, and years later they turned it into a book, transcribed it, and they called it A New Pair of Glasses. And that was Chuck's way of describing spirituality. And it's as if, through our own thinking and our own editorializing about our life, we have ended up with a pair of glasses that could best be described as life sucks glasses. And whenever we put them on, we go, oh man, this is really a bad world. And when we work the program and we get to maybe step 9, where the promises are, and we suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves, they call us up to the front of the room and they give us a new pair of glasses. And they say, when you put these on, You are going to be amazed before you're halfway through. You are going to see things you wouldn't believe. You're going to see how wonderful the world is. And we put them on. And we look around and see how nice everybody is. The world, for the first time, makes sense. My life makes sense. Everything is, wow, it's just maybe the way God set it up. And it'll stay that way as long as I keep wearing those glasses. And so the advice that they give to us is, if I was you, I'd throw away that old pair of glasses. The funny thing is, just for luck, for old time's sake, we tuck them away. And then lo and behold, we try them on again. And we come running back to our sponsor. Oh my God, the sky's falling, it fell in, nobody likes me anymore, I can't stand it, my boss, my job went to hell, and nothing like that. He said, give me those, did you put those back on? Did you put those back on? Give me those back. This is captured in our 10th step when the big book says, we have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. That's what they're talking about. As long as you keep this pair on, things will be wonderful. They will be wonderful because God will make everything wonderful. And you will be even happy while you're going through something sad. Sounds impossible, but it's not. We have an underlying realization that everything's fine and this is just temporary, and so why get too bothered by it? The problem with that for us human beings is I don't have anything to do. I've been taken out of having a job as far as my life is concerned. God, 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 God. In the 10th step in the big book, about the third sentence, it says, we have entered the world of the Spirit. And then a few sentences later, it describes how now, having had the awakening, realizing that God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves, we have a very simple way of getting through the day. I don't know if you remember the sentence. It says something like, whenever we are disturbed, upset, resentful, angry, we ask God at once to remove them. Any questions? Oh, I'm getting upset. God, would you take that away? Thank you. When do I get into this? And I say to myself, okay, it's a given. God can give me a happy day every day. Wonder if I could do it. Wouldn't that be something? If I could pull off a good day without him. And that is the struggle that we have with our own ego. It is the struggle between having everything handed to us and wanting to do it ourselves. I understand if I ask for help, it'll all turn out great. But I think I'll give this one a shot. Myself. I think I'll give this one a shot myself. And then people see us that night in the meet and they go, Larry, what's wrong? What happened? You look awful. I thought I'd run my own day today. It's not going too well. Why don't you ask for help? Should have called me. I like having something to do. I I was in charge for all those years. I know you were in charge all those years. You got to a nut ward. Yeah, I know. The results aren't good, but I think I'm fine-tuning. If I fine-tune, I think I can do it. I can get this. I can get a handle on it. So what we may not realize as we start making success on the spiritual path is that when we came in, we desperately needed AA. And that desperation made us do things that we wouldn't normally do, like allow other people to make decisions for us. And so it appears that in the beginning, you want to desperately need spiritual help. But as some serenity and some peace of mind starts coming, we tell ourselves, wow, I don't need that much help now. I'm getting a handle on it. You understand what I'm saying? And I like to capture it with what I call the ego's prayer. A lot of people don't know that egos pray. If yours does, watch out. It doesn't like the word prayer, much less the word God. And an ego prayer might go something like this. God, I want to thank you for what you've done in my life. I came here a hopeless wreck. I had no friends. I had no job. I had no self-respect. I can't tell you what you've done for me. You have transformed my life so that I am now welcome in my own family. I'm respected in my neighborhood. I'm respected at work, and I sleep like a baby at night. I am here tonight to thank you from the bottom of my heart for placing me in a position where I no longer need you. Can you imagine doing that? Oh, yes. That's what happens. As we succeed, and life is, we get the feeling that we have, are getting a better grip on it. Without realizing it, we are telling ourselves that we are returning to a state of self-sufficiency, which is the exact opposite of our program. Our program says, you were desperate when you came in here, and you desperately needed, and you turned your whole alcohol program over. That's the beginning. If we do it correctly, we will continue to turn over more and more and more and more. In other words, we're going to start out being dependent and become more dependent and more dependent and more dependent. Just the opposite of what our self-sufficiency would indicate, which is what the sixth step is. We're entirely ready to have God remove all our defects. So we start out giving up our drinking because it's going to kill us. But what about the rest of them? Entirely willing. Doesn't that sound good? You got it. I like that. It's kind of like the deficit. Wouldn't you like to get rid of the deficit? Yeah, I want to get rid of that deficit. Okay, we'll raise your taxes and pay it off. No. Okay, we'll cut your favorite program and save on the money and pay it off. No. I want to grow spiritually, but I don't want to give anything up. I don't want to let go of any more than I have to. You understand what I'm saying? I just don't want to. And so we're stuck. Here we are. Step six. That's why Bill said a step that separates the men from the boys, the girls from the women. There we sit. Well, what do you think about that? Whenever I see step six, I think about way back on page 25, remember that sentence? Just hit you out of the blue. So almost in the beginning, we're just getting warmed up, being told we're an alcoholic, and then all of a sudden it says, by the way, God is everything or he's nothing. He either is or he isn't. What's your choice? I don't know. Right now he's nothing. Okay. God's nothing. That's your choice? How's it going? Awful, 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 awful. Well then, why don't you choose God is everything? I don't know. What is that? God is everything. Well, he's everything. He's this glass of water. He's Maurice. He's me. He's this whole front row, the back, the lights, everything. The trees, the water, everything. Everything, everything is God. God is everything. You got it? Okay, I'm going to try that. I'm going to go home and I'm going to go, God is everything. So I go in my house. God's everything, everything, everything. There's God. There's God. There's God. There's God. There's God. So I finally got that the whole universe is God and God is the whole universe. But no matter how hard I try, I come up with the following sentence. And then there's me. Wait a minute. We can't go, and then there's me. You have to be inside of everything. I know, but I don't think I am. I seem to exist in addition to everything. What is it that exists in addition to everything? Our story. You follow what I'm saying? In my story, I'm everything. And then there's all the universe and all that other crap. But so this, I'm suddenly realizing this program is getting too extreme for me. I came here just to stop drinking. After all, that's the name of the game. Just stop drinking. Just stop drinking. And I've been sober about 3 months. And my sponsor said, Sandy, you know, you're working on that job on the base here at Quantico, and you have access to petty cash, and I know that you're taking money out of there. And I said, I'm borrowing it. And he said, no, you're taking it, and that's embezzlement. It is a serious offense. You have to stop embezzling. And I said, huh, so it's a two-step program. No drinking, no embezzling. Okay, all right. I'll go along with that. Two steps, two things. Okay, good. Then he says to me, I want to talk to you about something. If you're going to try and restore your marriage, you're going to have to stop flirting around and trying to have these affairs. You just can't do that. Oh, it's three things. Three things in AA. Is that it? No drinking, no embezzling, no affairs. Okay, I'll go along with that. Well, every week he had another one. And another one. And another one. And that's where step six is. And the reason I bring it up is such the heart and soul of progress in our program. And so it looks at us. And the reason it's so hard is that we are both spiritual and physical. And the physical wants to run the show, but it gets us in a lot of trouble. You know what I mean? I let the physical take charge. I'm in jail. And I go, maybe I shouldn't let him run the whole show. I should try and get the spiritual side. So there I am, and I'll just run through this quickly. It is suggesting that we are willing to have all of our defects removed. All greed. This side of the room did not like the all greed stuff. All lust. Everybody want all lust removed? I don't see any hands, so I'm... And you suddenly realize, what do you mean all? All. Tyler Redd, have God remove all our defects of character. All envy. All laziness,
All gluttony, no sitting around doing nothing, pigging out. I love doing that. Yeah, but we can get that removed. We can get it removed. Wouldn't you love to see it gone, gone, gone? No lust, everything gone. Well, what are you then, dead? What is that?
So Bill writes, as you can see, most of us tend to settle for as much perfection as will get us by. As will get us by. You want to be totally honest? Yes. I would like God to make me a total... Well, actually, wait. I run my own business, and what I'd like to have is a reputation as an honest businessman. That's what I'd like. I don't want to be locked into being honest all the time, because there are times when you have to do a certain little thing here in order to stay alive. So put me down for 80% honesty, which is a significant improvement over where I am now. Okay, good. Now, if you check your own inventory, you're going to find, yeah, I'd like to get rid of about 60% of lust. I'd like to get rid of about 40% of greed. I'd like to get rid of 35% of gluttony, and I'd like to get rid of this 80% of sloth. I don't like the sound of that word. I actually would like to get rid of all of it. It sounds disgusting. Sloth. So I'm making fun of us about our reluctance to have a wonderful life. Sometimes we say it'll happen at God's time. This too shall pass. I say this too can be let go of. That's why it isn't passing. Yeah, I've had this resentment for a month. Well, why don't you let go and let God take it? I'm not through resenting. I'll let him... So, the defects are there because we won't let them go. We enjoy them. And so it isn't that our higher power is failing us and won't make us improve. It's that we won't let them. And that's what I wanted to say, is that our whole program is really letting go. That's the entire program. We let go of drinking, and then we inventory all the things that we have to let go of, which are character defects. We run them by somebody else so that we can see where we were fooling ourselves. And then we become entirely willing to have them go. And the process of becoming entirely willing to let go looks something like this. If you have a good sponsor, he comes over and he slowly pries another finger loose so that something else can be let go of. And if you have a good sponsor, he'll keep prying and prying and prying. Oh, you let go of all of that stuff. And the more we let go of, the more our lives are so simple and so effortless, and we realize how complicated we made everything. How complicated we made everything. And as we continue, year after year, it's a lifetime job to let go of something else. Think about step 10. What else am I wrong about? In the beginning, we didn't want to be wrong. You remember that? What do you mean I'm wrong? Well, look, it's this, it's this, it's this. And then I said, okay, Bill, you're right. And I said, no, you're wrong. And I said, well, no, that's the same thing. It's the same thing. Well, say it. Okay. It wouldn't even come out. I'm wrong. And then once we start admitting we're wrong and get rid of entirely wrong ideas about everything, we start seeing how free it is to get rid of stuff that we're wrong about. And step 10 is just going, what else are you wrong about? Go look. Maybe you can find something else. It becomes a happy exercise. Oh, my God, I just found something else I'm wrong about. Gone. Gone. So you can see spirituality is not getting anything. It's getting rid of things. Well, I've got rid of that. I got rid of that resentment. I got rid of this prejudice. I got rid of this cause. I got rid of this opinion. All of this is gone. And what's left is the pure energy of our higher power. We call it a program of attraction. What do you think people are attracted to? Energy. I don't know what it is, but there's something about him
that I want to find out about. I don't know what it is, but when I'm near her, I feel this serenity. I don't know what she has. We don't know what it is, but we know what when we feel it. This is what you are made of. That is what is inside of you. It's being blocked by the story that we created about all these things that we're wrong about. So I'm going to close by just pointing out that if you look at the prayer of St. Francis, and it talks about all these wonderful things that St. Francis was able to achieve and learn. And when he talks about that where there's hatred, I bring love. Where does the love come from? That's who we are. It's there. Where there's error, I bring truth. I am the truth. I've covered it up with all this other stuff. So as we let go of more and more, that prayer becomes visible. And we see where there's darkness, you will bring light because that's who you are. The more spiritual, the more we throw away, the more we let go of, the more light comes out. It just starts shining. As that light shines, it changes your day. You go to the grocery store. People are affected by that light. I'm using that term, but they're affected by your loving nature, and they respond. And you come home and you go, everybody was so nice today. How did that happen? They were responding to us bringing out the best in them. Back in our drinking self-centered days, we brought out the worst in everyone. And as we brought out the worst, we came home at night and wondered why the world was so awful. And so I encourage all of you to let that light come out. You are going to love the view. And it happens to everyone. Thank you all very much.